Miss Monlay.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Gabon is a rich country in Central Africa, which has been ruled by the same family for 56 years. The Bongo family, first father Omar and then son Ali, have been the presidents of this country since 1967 until the August 30th coup. On Monday, the military leader of the coup, General Brice Ngama, was sworn in as the country's transitional president. On this edition of The Spotlight, we'll take a look at future possibilities for the country of Gabon. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Inam Richardson, organizer, All African People's Revolutionary Party out of San Francisco, California. And Harley Schlanger, spokesman of La Rouche, organization out of Potsdam, Germany. Thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off in San Francisco with Inam. In my opening, I mentioned that Gabon is a rich country. But what about the average citizen there? Have the majority of the people benefited from those riches?
We have to understand that Gabon is a super exploited country that's been pillaged for a very long time, especially by France, its former colonizer. So the Bongo family, which was in power for 56 years, was able to maintain a certain level of personal and familial wealth through cutting certain illegal deals with France, French politicians, and French enterprises. One notable example is the ELF scandal. ELF has now been rebranded as Total, but it's France's primary energy company. Gabon is very rich in petroleum, as well as uranium, and France has long benefited from those resources. The Bongo family, which has been historically allied with France, has benefited from those resources, but the masses of Gabonese people have not seen, any sort of material improvement in their lives through these resources.
Well, Harley, the Bongo reign was filled with corruption and theft. Former President Ali Bongo is said to be one of the richest men in Africa, with a net worth of over $1 billion. With this track record, your perspective of how the Bongo family was able to hold on to power for so long?
Well, first of all, they had the support of the French. And this is extremely important because the idea of France-Afrique, the French control of the former African colonies, they never really ended colonialism. And Bongo is an example, the family is an example of people who benefited from a very tight alliance with French corporations. The previous speaker mentioned the Total connection. Look, Gabon is the second richest per capita country in Africa, but the mass of the population lives in poverty. And this is typical of French West Africa. But what we're seeing now is an awakening of people in Africa. The coups are an example of nationalists in the military acting on behalf of the people. Now, what will happen ultimately in Gabon is still up in the air. There are rumors out, spread probably by the French, that this coup is run by leaders who are trying to work with the French. But I think we're seeing a new period where leaders are emboldened to say, we will not be subservient to your colonial powers anymore. And that's the reality in Gabon, where the people are out in the streets supporting the coup.
Okay, well, the coup took place because, according to coup leaders, they disputed the legitimacy of the recent election, which had renamed Ali Bongo as president. Your thoughts in general, was this coup really because of the election results, or would it have taken place regardless, in your perspective?
Well, I think there's still a lot that rests to be that remains to be seen with this coup. We know that the people certainly want to have a leader like Assimi Goïta of Mali or Ibrahim Traoré of Burkina Faso, and we do certainly hope that Nguema follows in the footsteps of these other coup leaders who have expelled certain French institutions within their country. However, there are reports, as the previous speaker mentioned, that Nguema does have ties to the Bongo's inner circle. And one thing that we saw was that Bongo, before he left power, suspended French media. So it suggests that maybe there was some tension that was developing between that relationship. And Nguema has reinstated the French media. So France 24 and RFI, Radio France International, are now operating again. So I think there's still a lot that we need to see in regards to how things unfold. But certainly, the masses of the people are waiting for the type of leadership that we've seen in these other coups that have taken a very clear position against the former colonizer and have begun to seek out genuine partnerships for their states that have the interests of the people in mind.
Well, Harley, I want to bring up something that Inam talked about, that it's early to see the direction of this coup and who this new president really is. I mean, there are reports that General Nguema, who is a cousin to the Bongos, also is a millionaire, and some say perhaps even propped up by the West. I mean, your thoughts on this overall and the possibility?
Well, I think the West is acting very stupidly overall, given the situation that's taking place in Africa, especially after the recent conclusion of the BRICS summit. What we're seeing now is the Global South is going through a second phase of decolonization. The first decolonization, especially in the French countries, was a fake, that they granted a cover of independence, but they put in power people who were totally dependent on France for military, for credit. They put these countries under the control of the international banking institutions. And those banking institutions were primarily predatory looters who insisted on no spending on infrastructure, on education, healthcare, and so on in those countries. So regardless whether this coup is totally real or not, there's a process underway that's unstoppable. That is, nations asserting their right to sovereignty, meaning governments that defend the interests of their people. So it's really the ball is in the court of the people in these countries. That's why it's so important to see these demonstrations, to see people in the streets saying, we will not be colonies anymore. And this is something whether Blinken and Biden and Macron think they can put the genie back in the bottle or control it with some new cover story. It's not going to work, especially given the power and the enthusiasm internationally in the Global South for what happened in Johannesburg, South Africa with the BRICS conference last week.
Well, speaking of the colonial rule, I want to look at that a little bit more because what a lot of people perhaps do not realize about the French role and the colonial tax that has definitely contributed to the poverty, not only in Gabon, but in 13 other African countries, which have to give France 85% of their annual income. I want to talk about that. If you can open that up a little bit and explain about this colonial tax and the effects that this has had on the African continent.
That's a really important question, and I don't think it's talked about enough. So I'm currently in San Francisco, but my primary residence is in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, one of the 14 countries. We can say 15 if we include Comoros, which has a similar system under a different name, that uses this currency called the CFA franc. This currency grants France enormous power. Not only are a significant portion of our national reserves held in the French Treasury in Paris, but France also has voting and veto power in the regional banks of both West and Central Africa. So as these African states are diversifying identifying their partners, choosing to align with interests that are more strategic and less neocolonial in nature, there are certain powers that France still has to block certain economic exchanges, which is why on the ground in countries that have had some of these coups, like in Burkina Faso and in Mali, the masses of people are now demanding that this question of the currency be addressed. And so I really think this is going to be the next step. Now that we've seen some of these governments expel the military and crack down on French media propaganda, I think the next move will be to start really looking to create a sovereign currency that doesn't allow for France to have this level of direct economic control within our economies.
Well, I want to look at that. Harley, you talked about the international banking system. I want to look at the role of a lot of these international organizations in propping up this type of neocolonialism on the African country, African continent. We see, as I said, allowing 85% of the annual income of these countries to be put in French treasuries that these countries had little access or small access to their own money. And also loans and so many other things that we've seen with these international organizations, especially the banking institutions. Your thoughts on the role that these international organizations have played in helping the settler colonial states continue their neocolonialism?
The International Monetary Fund should be shut down. It's an agency that works on behalf of private banks and corporate interests to make sure that debt is paid first, and more importantly, that the debt keeps growing, that the service, the interest on the debt requires more and more resources. And look, here's the point. The countries that are having these coups in Africa are very wealthy when it comes to raw materials, but the raw materials are not available for the people to use them in that country. Instead, they're shipped to the mother country. In this case, take the case of Niger. Niger is the largest uranium producer for France. 70% of France's electricity comes from uranium. Only 15 to 20% of the population of Niger have electricity on a daily basis. So what the Global South countries are saying is these resources should be used and developed in our own countries for the benefit of our own people. They're not opposing trade, but they're talking about fair terms. Under the IMF, under the World Economic Forum policy of deindustrialization, under the World Bank, the investment is not allowed in physical economy in these countries. So their resources are not part of the wealth of the people. And this is what was discussed by Dilma Rousseff, who's the president of the New Development Bank of the BRICS. She said, this bank will generate credit for and by the countries of themselves, and they'll use national currencies as opposed to having to change their currencies to dollars, which puts them at an additional disadvantage. So we're seeing a revolution internationally. The French don't like it. The United States doesn't like it. But I think this is going to be unstoppable.
In it, we have seen strong African leaders in the past who wanted to fight for their countries or the continent's sovereignty. And we have seen them overthrown in coups. We have seen them being assassinated. Your take on this, I mean, we see the situation, especially if we look at what is happening in Niger or Burkina Faso. Your thoughts on that and the role of these entities such as the United States and France in trying to turn around this progress by these countries?
Well, I think this is inevitable. If we look at Western economies, I mean, their economies, the foundations are heavily based off of the exploitation of the Global South and Africa in particular. I mean, Niger is a prime example. It's a great one. We have a country that is very rich in uranium, and a third of French households historically have relied on Niger's uranium to light up, you know, for basic electricity. The Eiffel Tower itself, a symbol of France, relies on uranium for Niger to supply its energy source. Meanwhile, Niger is a country where the majority of people don't have access to electricity. So when we look at the way Western states act, like the United States, like France, you know, they act in their interest and they carry out what coups, they carry out assassinations, they rig elections. They're implicated in all of this. It's a lot of it's declassified. Oftentimes they'll confess to it, but African people lack the power right now to defend ourselves. This is a part of the reason why Mali and Burkina Faso have been calling for an African federation. The people on the grassroots level understand this to be Pan-Africanism, and they're calling for a unified Africa, understanding that if Africa unites, that they'll be in a position to defend themselves. But when African states go about this alone in isolation, there does tend to be, you know, some sort of coup against a popular leader, some sort of assassination, or some other attempt at regime change. It's an ongoing cycle that African states have been through since independence.
Well, Harley, your take on that, and I'm talked about the importance of solidarity with these African states. Now, we have seen a growing number of states actually come together and say that, for example, they would not allow Niger to be attacked. At the same time, we have other African nations, part of the African Union, for example, who a lot of their leaders are in the hands of the West, who say they want to attack. So it seems like the West is continuing their very strong and long-lived policy of divide and conquer. Where do you see this going right now? Do you think that, as you said, this momentum has started and will continue? Or do you see more and more interference by the West, perhaps through some of the proxy leaders that they have on the African continent?
Well, I expect there'll be more interference, but the question is, will it be able to succeed? Let's take a classic case of this, the case of Gaddafi and Libya, where Gaddafi was moving to use the oil resources of Libya to improve the standard of living, to build universities, new cities, water projects. Libya was moving into the modern era, and the U.S., under the direction of, in this case, the British and the French, carried out a regime change coup, including a murder of President Gaddafi. What was his real crime? He was talking about a unified African currency backed by gold and oil. Now, let's learn the lesson from that. The problem of, as you mentioned, if there's no solidarity, you can pick nations apart one after another, make special deals, work out projects where you promise money to a leader and basically bribe them, like we see with the U.S. and Zelensky in Ukraine. Now, what's changed is that we've gone past the point of no return. The idea of sovereignty is at the center of the biggest battle on the planet right now, which is the proxy war against Russia in Ukraine, because Russia stands for sovereignty, national sovereignty. So do the Chinese. And for them, sovereignty is a question of the economic development of a nation and the right of the people of that nation to benefit from their own labor, their own resources, and so on. So that's what the fight is about. And I think with the BRICS, with the New Development Bank, with the fact that the West hasn't been able to succeed in backing down Russia or China, and the fact that you have more countries, 40 countries, applying for membership in the BRICS, including a number of African countries, and of course Ethiopia and Egypt were added to the BRICS. So this is a fundamental change in modern history, and as I said, it's a second stage of decolonization. I don't think they can stop it without massive bloodshed. The question is, will the people of France, will the people of the United States support French and Americans dying in Africa for the sake of oil companies, raw material cartels, and so on?
Hmm. Well, in your perspective, is there a difference between the coup, for example, in Niger and the one in Gabon?
Well, I think it's really early to tell. But I guess I'll say that I have, it seems that there's a difference in some of the response to the coups, which is a bit concerning. So, for example, Borrell spoke out saying that, you know, as bad as coups are, in his opinion, we have to understand the context of Gabon differently because the elections are rigged. And so it's like we're seeing a little bit of some of the tune being changed, which is a bit concerning. But I do think it's still early to tell. And I do think what the other guest is saying is very important, which is that really what we're seeing in a lot of African states right now is that leadership is oftentimes forced to be submissive to the will of the people because there's so much clarity on the level of the masses in terms of what they want. Their demands have become so clear. So I think we still have to wait and see. Is Nguema somebody who is aligned with the West? Is he somebody who is going to take some of the steps that Tchani in Niger has already taken? Niger, for example, is kicking the ambassador, the French ambassador, out. He's refusing to leave. They've cut his electricity. They've cut water to the French embassy. You know, they've already dissolved the French military court. So they've very quickly taken some of these steps. I think, you know, time will tell what direction Gabon heads in, but definitely this is what the people want. And you know, we definitely, of course, hope that Nguema understands that, you know, right now, you know, we're not in a time and place where there's a possibility of clinging on to power and also supporting or aligning closely with Africa's former colonizers. That's not where the masses are at right now, and I really don't think they'll put up with that if that is something that is a possibility.
Well, Harley, your perspective, what will it take for the coup in Gabon to transcend into a type of government that the people of that country want?
Collaboration with their neighbors, which is already taking place. Collaboration with the bigger neighbors with energy, with power. You know, one of the problems in that area is Nigeria, which is heavily influenced by the British. But even in Nigeria, the push to get ECOWAS to intervene in Niger has run into real problems. So on the one hand, you have the neighborhood, which is resistant now to going back to the old colonialism. But that's why I say we have to have a broader international perspective, because this world is changing dramatically. We see it with the China-Iran trade deals. We see it with Iran and Saudi Arabia and rapprochement. We see it with the use of national currencies moving towards an alternative to a dollar system. And one of the few powers that the Western banks have is sanctions, seizing money, seizing resources. Well, how are they going to do that with every single country in revolt? So I think this is where we can say that if the regime in Gabon wants to become a democratic regime and do what's right for its people, it cannot go back to the same deals they've had with French corporate cartels, and it has to act to do things such as infrastructure development, providing electricity, healthcare, roads, connections, internet. These are things they can do. And if they do it, then the impulse of the people will be with them. And I think that's what your other guest is pointing out. The people don't want more colonialism. They want freedom. They don't want to be subservient to Paris or to London or to Wall Street. And that's the change that's taking place in the world.
Yes, the change from that unilateral to that multilateral world. Well, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Adam Richardson, organizer of All African People's Revolutionary Party out of San Francisco, California. Harley Schenker, spokesman of LaRouche organization out of Potsdam, Germany. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, thanking you for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 31st verse.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وقل للمؤمنات يغضضن من أبصارهن ويحفظن فروجهن ولا يبدين زينتهن إلا ما ظهر منها وليضربن بخمرهن على جيوبهن ولا يبدين زينتهن إلا لبعولتهن أو آبائهن أو آباء بعولتهن أو أبنائهن أو أبنائهن أو أبناء بعولتهن أو إخوانهن أو بني إخوانهن أو بني أخواتهن أو نسائهن أو ما ملكت أيمانهن أو التابعين غير أولي الإربة من الرجال أو الطفل الذين لم يظهروا على عورات النساء ولا يضربن بأرجلهن ليعلم ما يخفين من زينتهن وتوبوا إلى الله جميعا أيها المؤمنون لعلكم تفلحون.
And tell the believing women to reduce some of their vision and guard their private parts and not expose their adornment except that which appears thereof, and to draw their head covers over their chests, and not display their adornment, except to their husbands, their fathers, their husbands' fathers, their sons, their husbands' sons, their brothers, their brothers' sons, their sisters' sons, their women, that which their right hands possess, or those male attendants having no physical desire, or children who are not yet aware of the private aspects of women. And let them not stamp their feet to make known what they conceal of their adornment. And turn to Allah in repentance, all of you, O believers, that you might succeed.
Now, dear listeners, as you could hear in this 31st verse, we said that one of the important factors in changing the communities is this factor of veil. We said, upon explaining the philosophies of veil, that there are different reasons for having veil and covering in the society. And there are also different challenges, different problems like divorce and separation, like indecency and increasing number of illegitimate children, like the meanness and degradation of women's personalities. They are all the challenges that this kind of modern life has brought for specifically the Western communities. I mean, as we explained, how can a woman with her moral characteristics achieve high status? How can they show their knowledge in that kind of society in which they are only seen as products? It is really sorrowful that in Western countries, and in Western-influenced countries actually, lewd and promiscuous women are most famous and acquire the highest earrings. They achieve everything they want. They whatever they want is actually at their service. Everything is in favor of them, who are known as artists and actresses. This is not the kind of life. These are not the exemplars for the children to follow. Wherever they go, they are welcomed by organizers of defiled places in which people fall over themselves for them. And we had, of course, such a situation in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. We thank Allah that the people's views towards women is now changed. And they are now really valuable. And they have high personalities. And they can reach high status. When the women veil themselves, they are not isolated from the society now, and they are participating in all good and edifying activities, even in the holy defense. Women have played their roles, and we have seen what happened because of women. Dear listeners, one part of the verse that needs discussion is this one. As we saw, in the third ordinance, the cases in which women are allowed to unveil themselves are mentioned. And one part is this one. أَوِ التَّابِئِينَ غَيْرِ أُولِي الْإِرْبَةِ مِنَ الرِّجَالِ. The male attendants, void of sexual stimulant. The commentary of this Quranic sentence, the male attendants void of sexual stimulant, is this, that أُولِي الْإِرْبَةِ, the word the Arabic word irba, is derived from the word Arab. And Raghib says in Mufradat that it means desperate need that man finds way to gratify it. And it is sometimes used as an absolute need. Now, what is the purpose of غيري أولي الإربة, or actually أولي الإربة in the first place? The purpose of this phrase, أولي الإربة من الرجال, is those persons who have sexual desire, who need spouse. Therefore, the Quranic phrase غير أولي الإربة includes the ones who do not have such desire. That to whom this sentence refers is a matter of discussion, of course, between different commentators. Some commentators believe that it is referring to the old men who have no longer these sexual desires, such as the women who are actually beyond the conventional age for marriage. Some other commentators say and believe that it refers to men who are not able to have actually sexual desires. And some commentators also say that its purpose is those who are neuter, that is, they have no sex organs at all. But whatever can be said about these verses is that they are not able to satisfy their needs through sexual desires, and women are allowed to show themselves or display their adornments for these class of people. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
When faith begins.
The 20th of Safar is the day of Arba'in, which marks exactly 40 days after Ashura and the heart-rending tragedy of Karbala. Arba'in is a day of pilgrimage to the shrine of Chief of Martyrs, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace be upon him. Pilgrims arrive in Karbala, Iraq, in their millions from all over the world, and many on foot. We here at IRIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Arba'in.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Arba'in is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, commemorating the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. People of various nationalities, including Afghans, are marching toward the holy city of Karbala in Iraq.
I am one of those longing to walk to the holy shrine of Imam Hussein and his companions in Karbala. I just registered in a caravan today. I can't wait for the arrival of Arba'in and the chance to fulfill my dream of joining the march.
I am very glad that I'm going on this trip to Karbala. I thank Iran and Iraq for facilitating the granting of our visas. We are all joining the Arba'in march, and I pray that God blesses all lovers of Imam Hussein in this journey.
Religious experts say that Arba'in is a demonstration of Shia Muslims' unity and their commitment to their sacred values. They believe it's not only a religious duty, but also a political statement.
Arba'in is one of the most important and valuable occasions for freedom seekers and those who follow the school of Ashura. It's a way of showing their loyalty to the values and principles that Imam Hussein defended, such as justice, dignity, and freedom. It's also a way of resisting the tyranny and oppression that they face from arrogant powers.
According to experts, the participation of Shia Afghans in the Arba'in March is proof of their resilience and devotion in the face of adversity and oppression. It also highlights their goal of preserving their religious identity and traditions. The Arba'in March is a spiritual journey to the holy city of Karbala. Afghan Muslims join pilgrims from other countries to renew their allegiance to Imam Hussein and his thoughts. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan has paid a visit to the Islamic Republic of Iran upon the invitation of his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian. In a meeting, the two ministers discussed the possibilities for further advancing bilateral cooperation in all fields and to exchange views on current regional and international developments. activating the Joint Economic Cooperation Commission, strengthening political synergy, following up on neighborhood cases, and consultation on regional security issues have been among areas of talks between Iran-Turkey diplomatic delegations.
We've discussed the implementation of the comprehensive plan for long-term cooperation between Tehran and Ankara that was concluded during Mr. Erdogan's visit to Tehran. The agreements between the two presidents are on the right track. We also reviewed plans to increase the annual trade volume to 30 billion euros, and good arrangements have so far been made to achieve that target.
Negotiations have been held in Tehran about the efforts to ensure security along the common border, fight against terrorism, facilitate transportation, and raise the value of trade exchanges. We are delighted about the reconciliation between Tehran and Riyadh. Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia are responsible countries in the region. We call for the improvement of bilateral ties with Tehran through tangible mechanisms. We believe the two countries should fight terrorism in the region as powerful allies.
The Turkish official's visit to Tehran comes after his trip to Moscow. According to analysts, in view of the two countries' current trade volume of almost $15 billion, the volume of political exchanges between Iran, Turkey and Russia is increasing. And this indicates the will of the Tehran-Ankara-Moscow triangle to raise the level of cooperation and resolve some regional cases diplomatically.
Collaboration and synergy regarding Syria, mutual efforts to neutralize sanctions and pressures against both countries, and joint planning to deal with illegal immigrants are some of the areas in which Iran and Turkey have common interests that can bring both nations closer. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Remembering a national hero, a symbol of resistance. Many Iranians this year are marking the National Day against British colonialism at the resting place of a man who organized a popular resistance movement against British troops that had invaded Iran in 1915. Rais Ali Dilvari's martyrdom anniversary has fallen just days before Arbaeen, allowing pilgrims who are taking part in the Arbaeen walk to mark the occasion at his resting place in Wadi As-Salam Cemetery in the Iraqi city of Najaf, where the pilgrimage begins.
Rais Ali Dilvari was a hero just like Martyr Qasem Soleimani in our days. Actually, as Iranians, I think we're lucky that we had had quite a number of these freedom fighters. For example, the Jangal movement of Gilan and the Tangistanis who formed the main resisting power against the British Empire in southern Iran.
We know that he was a young man living in the city of Dilvar in Bushehr province, and he successfully fought against the British invaders. That is why we have to keep his memory alive and educate our young generation about him.
Martyr Rais Ali Dilvari played an important role in the fight against colonialism. As Iranians, we owe him our independence and freedom. Rais Ali Dilvari was born in 1261 in Dilvar in Bushehr. After the sudden entrance of British forces into the southern province in 1915, he led the Iranian army in their fight against British colonialists. Rais Ali Dilvari was ultimately killed by Anglo-Indian forces following months of bloody clashes. Today, his home has been turned into a museum and registered as a national heritage in Iran. And to commemorate him, his martyrdom anniversary, which usually falls on the 3rd of September, is marked on the Iranian calendar as a national day of fight against British colonialism. Decades after his martyrdom, Rais Ali Dilvari is still an inspiration, not just for Iranians, but for freedom fighters worldwide. Gisum Shahmadi, Wadi As-Salam Cemetery, Najaf.
On Friday, trade and base unions held a nationwide strike over what they call a shameful number of deaths at work. On Wednesday, five maintenance workers were hit by a train while repairing tracks on the Milan-Turin line in northern Italy. The day after, two more workplace fatalities occurred, bringing the total number of deaths on the job to over 700 since January. Unions are saying these tragedies could have been avoided.
Questi governi hanno sempre richiamato.
Yes, these deaths could have been prevented. As safety in the workplace costs money, companies prefer to save on worker safety, this way making bigger profits. Our railway system was in the hands of the state until not long ago. Today, most of it has been contracted to private firms. Private groups only know how to offer services at the cheapest rate. It's like a rat race. If workers complain about their working conditions, they are fired.
On Friday, prosecutors placed under investigation an employee of the National Rail Company, RFI, in relation to the accident in which five maintenance workers were hit and killed by a train. Safety in the workplace is an issue of increasing concern in Italy. According to the European Union's statistical agency Eurostat, 776 fatal accidents on the job were recorded in Italy in 2020, by far the highest number in the bloc.
La domanda che ci facciamo è...
On top of the deaths at work, we also have a high number of non-fatal accidents and practically no protection for workers on very demanding physically and psychologically jobs. Private companies must be given strict rules when doing workplace safety risk assessments, and their managers have to be severely punished when they fail to observe these rules.
Unions are demanding that the workplace safety issue seriously enter the political debate and that the country's work system finally comply with the EU safety standards. Max Civili, Rome.
On Friday, Amir Abdullahian met with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri, and caretaker Foreign Minister Abdullah Abu Habib. Both sides discussed the latest developments as well as challenges facing Lebanon on various levels. The issue of Saudi-Iranian rapprochement seemed to be a significant additive, which experts believe could prove constructive.
Any rapprochement between the countries of the region is in the interest of Lebanon. Saudi-Iranian agreements are a positive step, and they benefit the entire region, and they confront the U.S. ambitions and interests. We know very well that it was the U.S. that opposed this reconciliation, and they always stand against any rapprochement between any two countries in the region.
Iranian experts say Tehran's goal is to have a wider scope of cooperation in the region for the sake of mutual understanding among regional states.
Iran wants to use its bilateral relations with different countries in the region in order to create a multilateral format for cooperation. For example, to work with Saudi Arabia on helping Lebanon or helping Syria or helping Yemeni issue. And the vision which is aimed by Iran is strengthening these bilateral and multilateral cooperation against any external interference in the region.
Iran's foreign minister has stressed that Tehran will not hesitate to provide Beirut with any necessary need, but without any interference in Lebanon's internal affairs. Iran's foreign minister has always stressed in all his visits that the election of a president is an internal Lebanese issue. He also suggested that a positive Saudi perspective toward Lebanon could help break the deadlock in the presidential crisis. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Netherlands and Denmark are the only EU nations so far to have supplied F-16 warplanes to fight the Russian army. Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba told his EU counterparts on Thursday that more countries need to follow suit. He also claims sanctions against Moscow are being circumvented and need to be tightened up.
We should deprive Russia of the capacity to produce missiles and drones. We see that the production is increasing and they use Western elements, Western spare parts in it.
Experts say EU sanctions against foreign nations are set to become even less effective as groupings like BRICS expand further.
They see it as a momentum to say, okay, this is payback time. We are going to show the world that we are capable to build a strong, unified bloc together with Saudi Arabia, Iran, United Arab Emirates. This bloc, if it is well managed and well elaborated on, has a huge potential.
EU defense ministers have been told to ramp up their training of Ukrainian soldiers.
I still think that we have to do more and faster.
And I propose the ministers to raise the objective of the mission to 40,000 Ukrainian soldiers trained by the end of the year.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban insists Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. As an EU member, Hungary says it will block a proposed 20 billion euro financial package for Ukraine. Orban wants peace talks. Many others do too, as the EU is faced with a growing social crisis. Anti-war campaigners say it is disgraceful that the EU is now in an arms race with NATO, claiming the bloc has moved from being a peace project to a full-scale military operation. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On the anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Hibiri reminded the nation of Sadr's legacy, stressing that the only way out of any crisis is unity among Lebanese people. Hibiri called on all parliamentary blocs to participate in a seven-day dialogue in Parliament, after which there would be open-ended sessions to elect a president.
Dear Lebanese, exactly 1 year has passed since my call on the parliamentary blocs on the need to realize a national agreement by electing a president who unites and does not divide, a president who is supported by the Christians, but also by Muslims, and who is before all this a nationalist. Such an accomplishment could assist Lebanon in exiting its economic crisis.
45 years after his disappearance, Imam Sadr is still seen as the main founder of resistance against the Israeli occupation, while also representing unity among the Lebanese people.
The legacy of Imam Musa Sadr did not only not die, but it overgrows all the periods of Lebanon. And every time we have a crisis, we remember that only his teachings and what he was calling for can represent the salvation for this country.
This is a very sad day for us. Had Imam Sadr been alive today, we would not have had all these problems we are seeing today. We would not have had these political, economic, or social problems. But we promised him that we will continue his path.
Imam Sadr founded the Lebanese Amal Hope movement in 1974 and openly worked for the rights of the oppressed and the lower class in Lebanon.
Musa Sadr, the Lebanese Imam, represents all what does Lebanon represent. The unity, the ableness of living together, Muslims and Christians, the willingness not to surrender in front of evil. That's what Musa Sadr represents. They intended by kidnapping him to erase all his existence. His existence continued.
It's an opportunity for the Lebanese to remember what the Imam Sadr stands for as far as unity and peace and one country united for its own people.
The prominent Shiite cleric disappeared on August 31, 1978, during an official visit to the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Lebanon still holds former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi responsible for his disappearance, along with two of his companions, while blaming the Libyan authorities for concealing details which could uncover the fate of Sadr.
45 years on, and the case of Musa Sadr's disappearance remains unclosed. The people of Lebanon unanimously believe that this is not a lost cause, for his legacy and the values of resistance and justice which he fought for have not died down. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Over 600 Sunni clerics, scholars and thinkers from different parts of Iran took part in a meeting with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to share their thoughts on the issues facing the Muslim world. The meeting was held on the occasion of the Government Week in Iran. Addressing the meeting, Iran's president said a united Muslim society is the biggest obstacle to global arrogance.
An organized, coherent and united society moves towards a clear and purposeful destination. Having goals and being dynamic are the main characteristics of a nation. A united society and Islamic Ummah is the biggest obstacle to the global arrogance and the system of domination. And this is the biggest obstacle to the dominators. After World War II, when two power blocks were formed in the world, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the hegemonic powers considered the unity of Muslims as the only obstacle to their dominance. Therefore, they always try to take measures against the Islamic world, but unity is the best solution to counter such measures.
Sunni and Shia religious scholars and elites believe that global arrogance is seeking to sow discord among Muslims by creating obstacles, launching propaganda campaign, and forming tech theory groups. But the Islamic Ummah should be vigilant to foil all the plots.
Such a meeting provides a good opportunity to offer better practical solutions for forging further unity and convergence between Shia and Sunni. The government of the Islamic Republic does not believe in any separation between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Dr. Raisi believes that both Shia and Sunni Muslims are of one essence. Accordingly, good achievements have been made in the economic, political, and social status of Sunni Muslims in the country.
Regarding the existing commonalities among different sects of Islamic schools of thought, such a gathering would send out this message to the enemy that Muslims are united and they cannot easily create discord among Shia and Sunni Muslims.
If all Muslims get united and join hands, no enemy would dare to sow the seeds of discord among them. The enemies do not want Muslims to make progress, but if we are united and support each other, the enemies cannot do anything.
The participating Iranian Shia and Sunni elites and scholars unanimously believed that what they all have in common is to think about the country's national interests and problems, which can certainly discourage the enemies. Iranian officials and scholars attending this event believe that creating unity among Sunni and Shia Muslims is indeed a strategy for the Islamic Republic of Iran to help foil the plots hatched by the enemies of the Islamic world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran. Allah,
Allah, Allah, Allah, Allah. اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allah, ya Allah, subhanallah. Allah, ya Allah, walhamdulillah. Allah, wa la ilaha illallah. Allah, ya Allah, wallahu akbar.
We had a 4-to-5-person Islam at the dawn of Islam, and that Islam dweller was Fatima Zahra. There are far more humble Islams than this one, but what are their blessings? The blessings of these few occupancy Islams is such that it has filled the whole universe with radiance, and the road is long for a person to attain those blessings. These Islam dwellers, in their humble Islams, are at such a lofty level in the field of spirituality that the hands of heavenly beings also cannot reach them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear listeners, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. About the concept of self-confidence, Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh has this beautiful sentence. He said, let us think of developing our own personality. You know, this sentence is about self-construction and personal development. From the Quranic perspective, a person acts according to his or her character, his or her choices, behaviors, reactions, friendships, and enmities, and how he or she expresses his or her emotions are rooted in this personality and identity. The healthy personality is the root of positive and constructive behaviors and emotions. Similarly, the unhealthy personality is the source of irrational and improper behavior. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Book of Quran, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ قُلْ كُلُّ يَعْمَلُ عَلَى شَاكِلَتِهِ Everyone acts according to his own disposition. Surah Al-Asra, verse number 84. This verse views man's behavior as an outcome of his disposition. That is, no matter what man's action is, it is in accordance with his temperament. This verse also emphasizes the importance of working on the self and, in fact, training the soul in order for it to move in the right direction to reach high levels of spirituality. The religion of Islam has introduced several ways to develop and train personality. For instance, the practice of performing the 5 daily prayers helps build the discipline of making time for what is really important. Perseverance or sabr is also another practice, which is accepting the